Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a moment, Held in Trust, a Jesuit church in Liverpool, hosts an exhibition tracing the troubled history of Catholicism in England. And Building Bridges, Muslim and Christian scholars come together to study scripture across cultural and religious divides. Precious relic believed to be from Jesus' crown of thorns, a lock of hair and a tartan kilt once owned by Bonnie Prince Charlie, and a plain felt hat that belonged to a young lawyer, later to become St. Thomas More. Plus an impressive collection of ancient missals and manuscripts, vestments and other artefacts that were hidden away during the darkest days of religious persecution in England. All of these are now on display at an exhibition entitled Held in Trust at a Jesuit-run church in Liverpool, the northern city currently celebrating its role as the European capital of culture. St. Francis Xavier's is a beautiful Gothic revival church, founded by 9 former students from a nearby Jesuit school, not long after the passing of the Catholic Emancipation Act that put an end to active persecution or discrimination. Located in one of the poorest parts of Liverpool, the church is now hosting this free exhibition, which offers some rare insights into the religious history of those centuries, both in Britain and on other continents where Jesuit missionaries were carrying the gospel message.
A whole lot of snapshots of British history and British Catholic history are there in this exhibition.
The administrator at St. Francis Xavier and the brain behind this inspirational exhibition is Brother Ken Vance. I asked him how the idea first came about.
Yes, the idea came up about 4 years ago. Liverpool had just been awarded European Capital of Culture for 2008. And a group in the parish got together and thought, how can we celebrate this event? Now, our parish is situated in quite a poor area of Liverpool, so we weren't quite sure what to do. And then finally the idea came up that Stonyhurst College, which is about 50 miles away from SFX, St. Francis Xavier's, is connected. It's a Jesuit high school. St. Francis Xavier's parish started from Stonyhurst in the 1840s. And they had a whole series of beautiful treasures in their archives, and we thought, why don't we bring some over to Liverpool?
So that people can get to see these things. I mean, they're really quite a collection, aren't they, dating back centuries?
Oh, indeed. A lot of them were given to the Jesuits during penal times when the church was persecuted, and a lot of Catholics thought, oh, the Reformation will blow over and things will get back to normal. So let's just keep these and then bring them out of the cupboard after the dust settles. Of course, the dust hasn't settled. The Reformation carried on. And so we've still got all those bits and pieces that people gave us.
Tell us about some of the most impressive exhibits that will be on show then.
One of the main exhibits is Thomas More's hat, St. Thomas More. The hat itself he wore when he was a young lawyer, and he left it in the house of some friends on the continent. He visited them in Belgium, though it wasn't Belgium in those days, and he left it behind. And they kept it, and after he'd been martyred, they used to bring it out of the cupboard each year on the anniversary of his martyrdom. And then finally they sent it back to Britain, and it came into the possession of the Jesuits of Stonyhurst.
So that's one of the most interesting pieces. You've also got, I see, a book of homilies, for example, from Pope Gregory, dating back to 1170. I mean, some really ancient works here.
Oh, indeed, yes. There's quite a few beautifully illustrated manuscripts. We've got Cardinal Wolsey's prayer book. It was given to Cardinal Wolsey by the papal legate that came over to sort out Henry VIII's divorce proceedings. So that's got quite a bit of history in itself. And then several beautifully illuminated books of ours. And there's a prayer book from Saint-Chapelle. And in one of the pages, it's got almost an itinerary of the relics that were kept there. So you can spend ages going round these and marvelling at the wonderful illuminations and the gold, which still looks as if it was only put in there a day ago, you know.
Now, I was going to say, I mean, these things date back centuries. Where have all these things been kept over the years?
Well, when the church was going through a sort of persecution period, the penal times, the Jesuits, the British Jesuits, started a college on the continent. It moved around a bit depending on the politics of the day. So it was in Liège, Saint-Omer, and Bruges for a while. And people sent their precious articles over there for safekeeping. Held in trust is the title, and that's what they gave us, to hold in trust for better times. So this stuff was trundled around, kept in these colleges and trundled around from place to place as they moved. And finally, at the end of the 18th century, when things got quieter and more pleasant for the Catholic population in Britain, they came back over to Britain and landed at Stonyhurst in Lancashire. And they brought all these things out of the various boxes they were carrying, and they were now on display there.
So these exhibits really, in a way, reflect, don't they, the incredibly troubled history of the church, not just in Liverpool, but in that part of the world particularly.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah. And there's a beautiful chasuble made by Helen Winter. She embroidered it. In fact, she embroidered five for the Jesuits of her day. Now, three of her brothers were implicated in the gunpowder plot, and they all lost their lives because of that. And we had this little image of Helen in the next room while the plotters were plotting away, and there she was with her needle and cotton sewing away. But they are beautiful vestments. So a whole lot of snapshots of British history and British Catholic history are there in this exhibition.
Now, it's important, I imagine, that people from around the country come and have a look at these, and yet many of them won't know much about, apart from a few odd details, but most people won't know much about many of these stories of suffering and persecution, will they?
No, and we've got a beautifully illustrated catalogue, 200 pages long. The exhibition is divided into five different sections: pre-Reformation, Reformation, Recusant, and so on. And at the beginning of each of those sections, there's an essay by a British scholar on that period. So it gives them an introduction to that. And then each of the artefacts has two pages. On one side is a picture, and the other side a full explanation about what the artefact is and how it came into Jesuit hands.
You're talking a little bit about the past, the history of the church there in Liverpool, but even up until very quite recently, it was an incredibly troubled place to be a Catholic, wasn't it? I mean, it was almost as divided as Northern Ireland, for example, until not very long ago.
Well, more so in some cases, but St. Francis Xavier's Church is situated in one of the sort of epicentres of troubles in Liverpool, and every 12th of July when the Orange Lodge march, and it still does march from time to time, when they pass the church, the choir would sing in English, "Hail, Glorious St. Patrick," or "Faith of Our Fathers," while the Orange Lodge marched outside banging their drum. It was quite a traumatic period for the school children in our local school. But thank God that's over now, and the local vicar, Henry Corbett, comes along regularly, and he's visited the exhibition a couple of times already, and we have quite a few joint services together over the year.
Do you see this exhibition in some way as something that is bringing back a lot of these problems from the past, or do you think in some way it can actually help on the ecumenical journey there?
I don't think it's bringing the problems back. It's recognising the fact that they have happened, but we've moved on. And now we can look at these and say, well, you know, have we learned from the past? So it's an educational idea that we have about the exhibition.
If I'm not mistaken, there are also some interesting exhibits from other faith traditions, from Islam, Hindu, Buddhist pieces. Where do these come into the picture?
From a variety of sources. Stonyhurst is a public school, and in Victorian times, a lot of the former pupils, boys in those days, it's co-ed now, but they went out with the British Empire, as it was, and sent stuff back. So we've got a whole variety of things, and we wanted to make that statement that it's not just Catholic history we're representing. There's a beautiful piece of the Quran from the 10th century, and also a Muslim marriage contract from Victorian times. It's a beautifully illustrated contract, and one of the pages has 21 small squares, and that was to fill in the names of the children. So it was only not just Irish Catholics that had large families. But that's the Muslim bit. We got some lovely plates of Jerusalem from the 1850s, very early pictures of the Wailing Wall and of the site of the temple. And they're there. And then there's some ethnographical stuff from South America that were sent over, something from Brazil in the old reductions. We had reductions in Paraguay, the sort of centres that the Jesuits ran, educational and utopian type places. And a bell from there. We've got some Plains Indian moccasins, whole variety of things.
And this exhibition is free, isn't it? Open until the end of September?
Yes, open until the 27th of September. It's free, and we've been sponsored by a whole variety of people. So that's how we've been managed to keep it free. And one trust has given us money so that we can sponsor school groups to come. We can give them a subsidy for their travelling expenses, which is great.
You describe St. Francis Xavier as being in a very socially deprived area. Tell us a little bit about the parish today. It was once the largest Catholic parish in England, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed, yes, with 13,000 Catholics. Yes, it's a massive building. I mean, it's a Grade 2 star listed building. They started building it in 1843, and by the time it opened in 1848, there'd been the great hunger, the potato famine in Ireland, and it was too small, although it was built to hold 1,000 people. And they were going to put a fourth aisle into the church. Instead, they built a beautiful chapel at the side, which is the size of a small parish church. So it is a massive building. But as mentioned, it's in the second most deprived area in the country. The indices of deprivation are quite high.
So the sort of problems you're talking about are unemployment, crime, street crime, things like this?
Not so much street crime. Drugs are the biggest problem in the area, and we have quite a big problem. Liverpool being a port, it has problems of drug distribution. So it's one of the places that stuff is sent around the country. And some of our parishioners are in prison because of that. But that's the main thing. No big problems with break-ins and so on, so I'm not worried about the artefacts being stolen. But the deprivation and the level of education is pretty low.
So the church plays quite an important role, I imagine, in trying to, in some way, provide some kind of support for people on the fringes.
Oh, indeed. And we across the road from us, there's a homeless project which we're heavily involved in. We have a pensioners club. And this exhibition has given the parishioners a great deal of encouragement and pride. We've got about 50 helpers who are serving teas, welcoming people at the door and so on. And they're really proud that this exhibition is in their midst. So there's signs of hope all over the place.
My thanks there to Jesuit brother Ken Vance, administrator at the Church of St. Francis Xavier, and a reminder that Held in Trust exhibition is open daily until September the 27th at St. Francis Xavier's in Liverpool's Everton district. The Bible and the Quran were at the heart of a three-day seminar earlier this summer at the English College Retreat House, Palazzola, in the hills overlooking Lake Albano, just south of Rome. This peaceful and inspirational setting brought together some 22 Christian and Muslim scholars for the seventh in a series of seminars entitled Building Bridges. The meetings are organised by the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and the Catholic Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. This year, the scholars worked together on the rather grand theme, Communicating the Word, Revelation, Translation and Interpretation in Christianity and Islam. Though the organisers were anxious to keep the work of these meetings far away from the media spotlight, I caught up with one of the regular participants to find out more about the goals and the history of this important initiative.
George Carey began it soon after the events of the 11th of September 2001. I think he held it early in 2002 at Lambeth Palace.
Jesuit Father Dan Madigan is well known here in Rome for his pioneering work in setting up the Institute for the Study of Religions and Cultures at the Pontifical Gregorian University. He's now moved to Georgetown University in the United States, but still serves here in the Vatican as a member of the Commission for Relations with Muslims.
It was a meeting in which there were some big names and, you know, princes and heads of state and so on.
People with a certain amount of influence.
People with a certain amount of influence, but people also who were representing something. It was decided at that point that for the long term it was better to have something which was more reserved, more more private, in which people were not there to represent some particular group or some particular country, but they were academics, basically, and their field is the study of Islam, the study of Christianity, and interreligious dialogue. And so that approach has been important, because you don't have people who feel they can't say something because they're representing, you know, this university or that constituency.
But an independence.
Yes,
to be
a certain
able
independence, because they're just
discuss
academics.
The issues on the
yes.
table.
The other thing which is very interesting about this series of seminars is the methodology. We study texts. So often in dialogue situations, we talk about big questions. And you read out the big question that was behind the whole thing. But the way we do it is by choosing texts from the Quran and from the Bible in order to study together in great detail and at length. And that really focuses the discussion in a much more fruitful way than if you stay with all those abstract nouns of tradition.
It's interesting. This particular title is interesting, though, because of the fact that so many Christians think very firmly that Islam is a religion that cannot be interpreted, and therefore the very premise for the work that you've been doing is a mystery to some people.
It's always puzzled me that it's something that you hear repeated again and again, even in the highest quarters, that Muslims don't or will not or cannot interpret their scriptures. But you've only got to go into any Islamic library or any Islamic bookshop and you'll find a commentary on the Quran. One commentary on the Quran will take up, half a meter of book space shelf, 20 volumes, 30 volumes sometimes. It is certainly true that Muslims are suspicious of what they call interpretation, in the sense that they don't want to do what some people do with texts, which would be to say interpret them away. So you interpret it so much that it doesn't have any authority anymore, which is what they see that Christians have done with the Bible. It's you take it apart and you chop it up into little pieces and you say, well, this doesn't mean that and that doesn't mean this. And in the end, you've got nothing left. And many Christian biblical scholars have been rethinking their optimism about the so-called historical critical approach, that you don't find out how a motor car works, for example, by taking it all to pieces. You need to understand how it works together. So there's been this movement in Christian biblical interpretation, what they call canonical interpretation. So treat it as the sacred text of a community. Don't treat it simply as an ancient text that you need to understand where this verb came from or this piece of text came from, that book over there. That doesn't get you into the real role of Scripture, which is as the text of a community that believes. So it's just not true that Muslims don't interpret. There's a long tradition of legal interpretation, of trying to work out what is the context of this law in the Quran, what are the limits of it, who does it apply to, when does it apply, when does it not apply. There are very diverse opinions on some verses. Then there's a kind of mystical interpretation. What does it mean when it says the likeness of God is light? There's been mountains written on that question of God as light. People are coming to realize that any act of reading is already an act of interpretation. We think when we read things, we're just saying what's there, but what we think is there is actually at least partly in our mind and in our culture, and people have told us what's there. That is an act of interpretation. We focused a fair amount on that, but most of the Muslims who are there are academics, and so they don't have any problem with the idea of interpretation, and they're well versed in philosophical approaches in the Western world.
They would represent the different branches of Islam, or would they mainly come from the Sunni tradition?
They're mainly Sunni. Most Muslims are mainly Sunni. There were among them Shiite Muslims also. Some Muslims who would identify themselves more as Sufi, others as modernist. A range of positions and approaches. A number of them have worked also, have studied Christianity quite seriously too, and so they know very well our scriptures and our doctrines, and some of them have lived in Rome. So these are people who are able to do comparative understanding of things.
There is a lot more study, I believe, within the Christian world at the moment of Islam than there is, though, of experts, Islamic experts, who also study Christianity. Is that true still?
It is still true, but there's a very quickly increasing number of people who are studying Christianity among Muslims. I think a lot of Christians still who study Islam study it in the context of what we might call security studies. I mean, I come from a university where there's quite a lot of the study of Islam and of the contemporary Arab world, but
At Georgetown, yes.
Most of the people who are doing it are focusing on the question of, you know, Middle East politics, world affairs, and so on. It's not as common, I think, among Christians really to study Islam and take it seriously as a religion, and to enter into some kind of theological approach to it. That's a little more rare.
It's an exciting time to be studying the Islamic-Christian relations, isn't it, after the common word, which seems to have set a new impetus in motion.
I think that's true, yes. I would have hoped that more people had responded to it. But, of course, any initiative like this takes time to be accepted and even to be known. I mean, it's known, I think, in the English-speaking world, partly because the responses have been quite a high profile, I think, to it. I see, you know, signs of hope at the moment in this kind of dialogue. I mean, there are many issues, but I think one thing we're getting over, I hope we still have some work to go do on this, is to reduce everything again to that kind of the political question. The political question is enormously important, but there are many people in this kind of work who have no political power, who have no say. So we can't say to every Muslim, the one who's selling the umbrella, or the one who's, you know, our doctor, or the one who's a fellow teacher, we can't say to every one of them, well, I'm not really going to talk to you about anything else until you discuss the political question about religious freedom and so on. It's not something they can really do anything about, and we can't put everything else on hold until that is solved. And the people who really have some possibility to do something about religious freedom and so on are people we're not prepared to speak harshly to, because they've got the oil we want, or they've got the you know, a certain political clout that we want to use in international tactic negotiation. So I don't know. I don't think it's fair to expect the rank and file Muslim to have to answer for these larger political questions, and for everything else to be put on hold in the meantime. Well, we don't say to the Saudi king, well, we're not going to sell you any arms until you let the Christians there have some freedom of worship. The US is still selling billions of dollars worth of arms and buying billions of dollars worth of oil every day.
Talking about it as a time of hope, the common word represented in a certain way a step forward.
Yes, it was an attempt by a group of Muslims who know Christianity and have studied it well, to try and say, okay, let's not take the traditional road that we've always argued about. Let's see if we can find some common starting point. It's a common starting point. It's not a common finishing point. So it's not trying to say, well, you know, we're basically the same. It's trying to say, well, we have this in common in our scriptures. If we could develop this, maybe we'd have a chance of understanding each other better. And from that point of view, I think it's an attempt in very good faith. And I don't entirely understand why some people are so suspicious of it. I mean,
What do you think provoked it?
What provoked it? Well, It came 1 year to the day after the letter that a group of 38 Muslims had written to the Holy Father about the question of faith and reason. And that was a very interesting letter, really responding to what he had said at Regensburg and explaining to him a bit about their position and whether, in fact, what he had said was an accurate presentation of Islam. It was a very well thought out and clearly argued and respectful letter, and one which was open to further discussion. Well, that didn't receive any direct answer from the Pope, and that I remember speaking to one of the signatories of that about the middle of last year, and he was still hopeful. He said that you know, the delay, he said, meant that the people in the Vatican were working on the answer, and they were taking it so seriously that it was taking a long time to... Well, I'm not sure he was right, but still, on 1 year to the day, they decided to show that they were still ready and to take even another step. And it's a new experience, I think, for the Church in some respects, because since the Second Vatican Council, really, it's the Catholic Church that's been pushing because of the policy enunciated in Nostra Aetate and the fact that we have people full-time on this and a pontifical council devoted to it. The Catholic Church has been making the running in many respects. The World Council of Churches has certainly been doing work on this too, but in many respects a lot has followed on from Nostra Aetate. Now we're finding that we're not making the running. Here is a group of Muslims, quite a substantial group of Muslims, who are pushing the game along and showing that they are ready for dialogue and keen to have it and keen to have meetings. And they're serious scholars. They're people who've taken the trouble to understand who we are. Yeah, serious people. So we're playing catch up in some respects.
These latest developments have resulted in the establishment of a Catholic Muslim forum to be convened in November for the first time. What are your hopes for that? What would you like it to start looking at?
My hopes for it would be not too high, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but I think it's always important to keep in mind that the dialogue at its best doesn't necessarily happen on the big occasions in the high-level committees. Most dialogue takes place in very ordinary situations, and whether or not things are happening here in Rome or producing something, there is a lot happening all over the world, and so people have an unfortunate tendency sometimes to judge the stage we're at with Muslims as to how things are going in official circles, and I don't think that's a good measure. So it's going to be slow and patient work. You know, I wouldn't say, the November meeting's got to be the big breakthrough, and not because there's not goodwill, but simply because I think dialogue takes time and commitment and the preparedness to keep meeting and develop friendship and trust. One thing I would say, and I think it's very important for this meeting, which is a very significant meeting, I think. There hasn't been anything quite like it before. There's a tendency sometimes on both sides to say, well, when we get together with them, we're going to say to them, you know, you've done such and such. We're going to give people a list of their sins. So if it's a meeting like that, it's not going to go anywhere. We both have sins, surely, and we can usually enumerate the sins of the other without being quite as aware of our own sins. And the most difficult kind of dialogue, but I think the most essential, if we're going to break through, is what I call a dialogue of mutual repentance, where we can honestly say, well, these are our ideals. We have wonderful ideals, love of God, love of neighbor, peace, justice, any number of good things. When we get together and talk about our ideals, that's fine, but it's easy to get together and talk about our failings to live up to those ideals is much more difficult, takes much more courage. But in the end, that's the place we'll break through, because all the time that we're talking about ideals in the back of our minds, whichever community we belong to, in the back of our minds we're saying, yes, but they don't do it. So if we can meet on that level of honesty, and I think Pope John Paul was very important in this with his mea culpa during the Jubilee year. That's where we have to begin, although people are suspicious of that, and it's not easy. Whoever said confession was easy? But it's good for the soul.
And my thanks there to Father Dan Madigan, visiting international fellow at the Woodstock Theological Centre at Georgetown University and a member of the Vatican's Commission for Relations with Muslims. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.